Okay, so welcome back to the second half. So this week we're going to be looking at Kshanti, and I've written it up here, and we're going to say a bit more about what this word means. So in the last few weeks we've been exploring Shantideva's Bodhicharavatara. So it's a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. And within it, he himself explores the paramitas, the six paramitas, and these are the six perfections. Or another way of describing it is the six means of transcending yourself. The six means of transcending yourself. So we're going to have a look at Kshanti. Now, Kshanti is a word that doesn't have a direct English translation, but quite often it's translated as patience or forbearance. But, you know, it has a lot more. It's a very rich term. One definition of it is an attitude of determination to stay in positive mental states, even in apparently adverse circumstances. I'll read that again. An attitude of determination to stay in positive mental states, even in apparently adverse circumstances. Okay, so we're getting some idea of what it's about. So, if you might have seen these booklets, we've got some booklets on the reception. It's called Kshanti, and it's by Ratnagosha. Ratnagosha used to be the chairman here 10, 15, 20 years ago. Very, very good speaker. And writer, and he gave a series of talks on Kshanti, and these were put into a booklet. So I thoroughly recommend that, and all you need to do is give a donation. We're suggesting £1, so it's well worth a read. So Ratnagosha is a very fine mind, and he talks about the principles of Kshanti, but it also includes lots of practical examples as well. It's a very down-to-earth booklet. So he quotes Bhante Sangharakshita, and he says, Kshanti means patience. Patience with people. Patience when things don't go your way. It means tolerance, allowing other people to have their own thoughts, their own ideas, their own beliefs, even their own prejudices. It means love and kindness. And it also means openness, willingness to take things in, and especially receptivity to higher spiritual truths. So I was beginning to see there's quite a rich, rich term. So this is one of the key qualities the Bodhisattva needs to cultivate. So there's these six paramitas, these six ways of transcending oneself. And the Bodhisattva is one who seeks to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. He's trying to lead all beings to enlightenment. So I thought we could just explore what this word Kshanti is. So there's some words, like we said, patience, forbearance, non-reactivity, fortitude, endurance. So we're getting that sense maybe of what Kshanti is. The opposite of Kshanti is ill will, hatred, resentment, blaming, irritation, anger, reactivity. So again, maybe we can see what the opposite is. And quite often in Buddhism we talk about far enemy and near enemy. So the far enemy, if you like, of Kshanti is ill will and hatred. So it's a description of something that's just so far away from Kshanti. But the near enemy is often things we might get mixed up with Kshanti. So we might hear patience, and depending on what we think patience means, you can go away with an idea of what Kshanti is. So what Kshanti isn't, it's not indifference, it's not passivity, apathy, repression, denial of feelings. So you might go away with patience as a bit of a weak sort of emotion, depending on your conditioning, I imagine. But it's actually, because Shanti includes a lot of energy, includes great determination. And it's actually, so what we're trying to do is cultivate positive states of mind and stay in them. And as you'll know, through meditation, this isn't always easy, is it? You know, we try and cultivate the metta bhavana, and sometimes it can just seem a lot of work, can't it? You know, we can really need to work very hard with our minds. And Kshanti has this sense of effort, this effort that we need to work on ourselves. So it's something very active, it's an active quality. And it requires strength, but also courage to deal with what, you know, how we are in the face of difficulty. So the opposite is, as we said, hatred, ill will, and it's allowing events and circumstances to put us in negative states. So when I was reflecting on that, I thought, well, what is it? What is it about this? That what's, you know, and for me, it was the fact that we've got a choice. At the end of the day, we've got a choice on how we are and how we react to circumstances. And that's what the Buddha is saying, but that's also what Shantideva is saying, is that we have a choice. And we can act creatively or we can just react. And he's saying, so Shantideva is saying, he's trying to wake us up. He's trying to say, yes, you can, you know, we can act with love and kindness. We don't have to act with hatred and ill will. So beginning to look at the text, he starts saying, ill will and resentment destroy all the benefits of spiritual practice. Ill will is the most destructive state, and Kshanti is the best ascetic practice. So we should develop Kshanti in every way we can, and with all the effort we can muster. So he's saying ill will is the most spiritually destructive state. So do you agree with that? Or is it all right to have a bit of ill will?
I think when I'm angry, things just go out the window. Like you forget. You forget about quite a lot, and it just, you become quite focused on just your anger, or just that one person, or things like that.
Yes.
So I don't know if it's like the worst, but it definitely feels like it's the one that just sort of wipes the ball clean, and that's the only thing that's in your mind.
That's really interesting. I really noticed when you said focus, and I got that really had that sense of how our, we can lose perspective somehow. We can just, as it were, just focus on that other person or what they've done or how they are. And it's all our attention on that, as it were, and we've kind of lost, probably the lost, the rest of them as well, haven't we? We've sort of lost the rest of their personality, everything else they've done, maybe other things as well. Recognize. So it's kind of a loss of perspective somehow when we get into ill will.
I can see it a lot in people that are arguing with each other in the mat currently. You sort of just see how they sort of are focusing on one aspect of each other.
Yes. Great. Anyone else?
I think, I can see that you shouldn't feel ill will towards someone else because it's actually harming you. But if someone's done something really bad to someone else where it's led to, where it's changed their lives for the worse, then it's very difficult to not feel ill will. And you do try and not think about it all the time, and it gets better over time, but that takes time.
Yeah.
Can't force it.
No, exactly. I think you're right. And it's not about denial or repression. It's about fully being honest with whatever's going on. So Kshanti isn't saying you've got to be nice or, you know, this sort of get in front of yourself and sort of forgive someone before you've actually really felt that experience of ill will in you, you know, if it's going on. So with this, it's in a way, Kshanti is a very high teaching. So the Bodhisattva has taken on a huge vow. You know, they've taken on the vow to save all sentient beings and lead them to enlightenment. And so the Bodhisattva vow is one of altruism and realizing the connection with all beings. So Shantideva is really pointing out that ill will and hatred is actually the antithesis of what the Bodhisattva is trying to do. So in some ways greed is better than hatred, because hatred is actually a sort of a denial of someone else's existence. You're trying to sort of destroy them. Or hurt them. Hi.
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult ideal. I can think of all sorts of circumstances where you think, well, I'm getting cross, I'm getting frustrated.
Mm.
Maybe anger is a little bit too strong.
Mm.
And it feels much more healthy just to let it out. Tell someone you're frustrated.
Mm.
It doesn't feel like the worst thing in the world. I mean, there's something of honesty in some of these emotions.
Yes.
I mean, I recognise that the highest ideal, one should always try and be above all these things and frustrations and see things from a broader perspective.
Yes.
But I think there's a lot of therapy which talks about, you know, don't repress your anger. Let it out. It's worse to kind of press it down inside you. So it sort of feels like it's a difficult subject, a very high ideal.
Yeah. And it's an interesting area as well, because it's interesting. So when you said you like to, just as it were, if you're irritated with someone, do you say you just tell them you're irritated? Is that the sort of thing?
Well, I suppose if someone, if it's a situation where I'm telling you for the fourth time, you know,
right,
that's not going to work.
Right.
Maybe one should stop and reflect why have they ignored you four times?
Right.
Not taking your advice, maybe.
Yeah.
But I still think it's situations where sort of it's not easy, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
To always be that so.
Yeah.
That perspective.
Yeah. So Sangharakshita has an interesting view on anger. He says, so he doesn't want to say that anger is necessarily always unskillful, because he was saying if anger is used to break through into communication, it's actually very skillful because it's just energy, as it were. However, if it's used to try and hurt someone, that's when it becomes unskillful. So that's when it harms the other person and yourself. But if you can break through into communication, then it can be a skillful thing.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because we can tend to think, anger, that's bad, or something like that. But it's actually saying it's the object of the anger. That's the important thing to bear in mind. Now, the danger is that it's very easy to slip into ill will, as it were, from that. We need a lot of awareness to maintain the sense of really just wanting to communicate with another person, not to hurt them in some ways. So that's a working ground that you know we are bearing in mind, is it?
Maybe if you see it as a sign, you see it as a sign that something needs to be opened up or unblocked.
Because I mean, it's also interesting, isn't it? If that, you know, if you don't say anything and it just goes round in your head, well, that's still ill will, isn't it? That's resentment. So it'll probably come out in another way as well. So if we don't try and resolve our difficulties through communication, then...
Yeah, exactly.
So if anyone would go and just think, well, actually, it's good to really let it out and have a good old Barney and just... just, yeah.
Maybe this is, I'm thinking about it in the wrong way, but if you're angry about an injustice, and you go on a protest, or you're part of a campaign, or you are directing your anger at something which you feel is wrong for whatever reason, and you're at the same time trying to constructively be part of a solution, that surely isn't a bad thing.
I guess it's interesting just looking at actually what's happening. You know, are we targeting? Is it ill will, or is it, you know, is it, are we, do we hate a certain person or a certain organisation? Are we getting into a lot of hatred, really, or is it sort of more just energy, as it were, to make you, you know, sort of to you know, to actually protest or whatever. I suppose I'm not saying there's an easy answer to that, but
because it becomes quite blurred, doesn't it? If you feel passionately about something,
yes,
and you're trying to change it,
yes,
it's actually very easy to be angry and feel ill will towards
people
who you think are the
perpetrators
or the organisation that's the wrong values.
That's right. So there's a whole thing. I mean, within Buddhism, you say, well, we're all conditioned, so even the people who are in the organisation or the individuals that we're angry at, they're conditioned as well, as it were, you know, sort of caught in the whole loop, as it were. So, but also Buddhism wouldn't, you know, it's not a sort of, you know, we need a lot of energy as well to practice a spiritual life. So it's not saying we should be sort of quietist and just like a bit weak-willed. We need a lot of passion in the spiritual life as well. So, yeah, I'm not sure I've really answered your question, but sort of try to explore
it. It's more complicated than just a straightforward answer, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I have one question that's quite similar to that one. And I actually don't know the answer, but I don't know if in Buddhist way of viewing things, if hatred can exist, but in its true essence. I'm not talking about hatred in the part where you're building upon it or where you're creating ill will, and also not hatred toward a person or an organization, but maybe more like, and maybe hatred is not the good word, but you see something that you is unjust or something that you know, I don't know actually what would be the best word to describe it, something that doesn't have a seed of good in itself. And you can look at it and say that, okay, maybe I don't say I hate you, but I say I don't like it, but then I don't build upon that and just leave it at that point. I don't know if that would...
It's a bit difficult without some sort of example, I think, because
I don't know,
abstract,
one thing that always crosses my mind, something that I have as a woman of difficulty understanding, like rape, and say, okay, that is bad. I don't need or want to go into the reason why and how and what's behind, but I can say with feeling completely, not feeling hatred or not feeling anything, it's like feeling bad, unhealthy emotions inside of myself, just say, okay, it's bad, and pull myself away from it, but stating that something which I perceive as bad, calling it bad, somehow I see that as important.
It's really important to recognise that there is things that people do that are really harmful. Like you say, rape, there's murder, there's warfare, all sorts of things which are, you know, well, unskillful, but, you know, Buddhism would say are evil even. You know, some things that are very, very, very harmful towards others.
Because it seems like pure evil exists in this world in some way. Saying that it doesn't, it's, I don't know, for me, doesn't really feel very truthful.
Right. Certainly action, evil action, whereas Buddhism would say it doesn't attribute the evil to the person. So
exactly, it doesn't mean that. It's not the narrative of going into who did it and why they do it and all the other things that might be behind, but just looking at the thing and calling it what it is.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
You're exploring your thoughts, and so am I, so I'm not sure of the clear. The first thing that came to my mind was the story of Thangudimala, who was a serial murderer, who was killing everyone around. So it was evil, you know. It was really denying, not killing people. And what I find beautiful in the story of the Buddha is that he didn't just label Thangudimala as the bad one. He actually entered in communication. He didn't say, yeah, right, you know, that's the way you express your creativity, and we might keep on killing people. I don't know, it was not that. It was, he could hear, he could help him overcome that state of hatred and whatever was going on in his mind. So I know it's a really high ideal. I feel inspired by that.
I do agree, but all I hear, I still see the relationship. So it is a person, so of course you can feel a compassion, and there are all sorts of reasons why people do something. So there is, when you have a relationship, it's a relationship, so there is compassion for the person who did something bad or something unskillful. But the deed itself, the product, I couldn't feel compassion for the product itself when I remove the person from the murder. So
yeah,
I can feel compassion for both the victim and the murderer,
and
the murder itself.
I think that's true. I mean, it's good to not to, you know, not all actions, you know, some actions are very harmful. So it's good not to say, oh, well, that's all right. And Buddhism wouldn't be saying that. Buddhism certainly wouldn't be saying that. So it's just the language that we use. So we tend to use skillful and unskillful in Buddhism, where skillful acts are beneficial and are helpful towards ourselves and others, and unskillful are harmful towards others and ourselves. So it's a sort of slightly different terminology. We wouldn't tend to use good and bad. So it implies a certain degree of more intelligence and more, you know, a sense of reflection on what's, you know, you need your intelligence to act ethically, if you like. And it's a moving away from ignorance. So the people who do harm, and we all harm to some extent, you know, are ignorant, you know. So to the extent that we are ignorant, then we will do harm to ourselves and others. Hi.
I always think I have loads of opinions and views on sort of, you know, environmental issues and sort of animal rights and that. And sometimes for me it's very easy to slip into the sort of anger and just sort of, yeah, ill will, and I don't really like protesting and all of that, but like for me, advocacy seems like more like a better solution sometimes for me. Look, that's, yeah, I think that's a better way, but it's really hard, and sometimes I feel like just concluding it with saying, oh, everything is impermanent, seems to be the real sort of settlement for me sometimes. What would you say on that?
I'm not quite sure on when you were saying about everything's impermanent. What?
As in, yeah, all the pain that's happening in the world, and all the, yeah, just injustice happening. It seems like there's no solution to it, but then just thinking of it in terms of impermanence seems like the only way out sometimes.
Well, it's certainly a lot of suffering, isn't there? A lot of suffering in the world. And it's very complex, isn't it? And how we, you know, when we know an awful lot about the world now, don't we, through media. So it's very difficult to not respond in that way. And we can sort of respond in different ways, can't we? We can get very angry, or we can we might get despondent, etc. So it's we're in a quite sort of a difficult to know how to respond sometimes, isn't it? I think Buddhism would say, well, we want to try and make the world a better place. We want to try and reduce the suffering in the world as much as we can. And so we can do this by our actions, you know, how we live our lives, what we buy, and how we communicate with people, how we live our lives. So we can improve, you know, improve the situation. And the more and more of us who do that, then the more we can improve the situation. I mean, if everyone, you know, was more aware and lived with more kindness, then the world would be a transformed place, wouldn't it? So it's not these solutions, you know, it's probably not insoluble, although it's a big ask.
Do you think, thinking about impermanence, I was just turning back to impermanence would be a good sort of, I don't want to use the word solution, but like peace of mind, like,
I'm not, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe. Do you want to say something like that?
Yeah, I wonder if you mentioned, you would like to mention passivity as being a new enemy. So, when there are things that I think are an injustice or something that can make a difference, I will fight for it. Not violently, I hope. But I will fight for it. So just saying, oh well, it will pass anyway, or that's how it is. It's impermanent. For me, it's not enough. You know, that would be being more passive, and I wouldn't like to be passive in the world as a world at the moment, please.
I don't mean in terms of being passive, but like, for example, I'm not trying to offend anybody in this room, but like, I'm not going to try and convert anybody into a vegan, and that would just not work, because that's not, it's not going to work, it's not possible, and it's like when you reflect on that pain,
it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult.
Great, thank you.
And on the subject of anger and ill will. Just as Todd was saying, you get that cloud, or everything else kind of becomes blocked out. But another part of, a part of that also is that anger is quite a physical rising of energy. There's quite a lot of you know, you feel it. It's not just a mental thing. So, I mean, the thing that kind of strikes me is both that rising of energy and ill will, which kind of the ones that are actually quite physical. So the process then, would it be then, kind of going back to last week where we were working with mindfulness, is the process then to kind of do something like bringing mindfulness in, so that, for example, you're kind of working with one of the four foundations of it. So for example, aware of your body sensations as well as the others.
Yes.
So that you can then hold anger there. You're not suppressing it, but maybe you're holding it and you're holding mindfulness.
Yes.
And then maybe you can channel the energy. So then, rather than it channeling you because you've got no mindfulness and you're in its power, do you then kind of bring mindfulness to it and try and hold the two? So I'm assuming it's possible to hold the two without one blocking the other out.
Yeah, I think that's really, I think you're touching on something really important, and bringing mindfulness, like you say, into physical sensations, if you're feeling anger in the body, into your feelings as well. So, and if we can, the more we can bring awareness to physical sensations, emotions, thoughts, we can create this gap. We often talk about this gap between feeling and craving, or it's between feeling and and ill will as well. It's the feeling and then the response. The more we can do the feeling and stay in the feeling, then the more we can choose. The more we can choose how to act. Because often, sometimes our anger is out there, and you know, it's before we know it, we've said something we later regret, or it's gone inside and it's sort of gone round ourselves before we know what we're doing. But I think you're right. I think it's what we're trying to do is encourage, you know, more mindfulness of what's actually happening, so we can then make better choices. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah. Because it's maybe this is off the mark, but I remember it being said that it's not possible to hold both anger and metta. So kind of metta kind of evaporates or dissolves that.
Yes.
So that's another possibility. But certainly it is possible to hold mindfulness and anger.
Yeah.
So therefore, actually, you can channel it, right? One doesn't cancel out the other.
No, it doesn't cancel. No, that's right. So it's more like going back to what you said about, you might talk more of, say, hatred and metta can't coexist at the same time, because metta is the well-wishing for others and yourself, and obviously hatred is the opposite of that, so the two can't combine. But our awareness, as it were, can be bigger than, you know, bigger than our hatred. It can be bigger than, you know, all the feelings. We can sort of, it can hold everything else that's in us, and over a period of time we can learn to deal with that and learn to make more creative choices. So maybe we'll move on with the text a bit. So Shantideva says, we feed ill will by allowing ourselves to become unhappy when events do not go according to our likes and dislikes. So I shall starve this con man rather than feeding him as my guest, knowing that his only purpose is to harm me. So again, he's using, you know, the con man is the ill will. But it's very interesting, he says, when events do not go according to our likes and dislikes. It's really interesting, isn't it? It's like when we don't get what we want, and when we've got things that we don't want, then we react, don't we? That's quite a natural thing to do, almost. But he's saying it's actually, when we do react, that's making us unhappy. So often, you know, we want someone to blame for that, or maybe we're blaming ourselves. Yeah.
I often find that I've arrived at some unhappy state, but I don't know why.
I recognise that as well. You know, you're suddenly in a mood or something, and you think, how on earth did I get here? I mean, I can only presume that it's the more awareness we have, and I think we notice that on retreat, don't we? We actually follow the process a bit better and go, oh yeah, I'm going in this direction, aren't I? I've taken, you know, the right instead of the left, as it were, in my mind, and I'm going in a certain direction.
What's the way that's not going to last?
Ah,
yeah. At the same time, I don't know how I got there in the first place.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a whole complicated array of things that will occur. I allowed to get under my skin.
That's it, isn't it? I think. And I suppose the more aware we can be, the deeper our awareness, the broader our awareness, we can begin to see that. There's the example that, is it Sogyam Rinpoche says? He says about, you know, a man walks down the street and falls down a manhole cover. And then, anyway, the next day he falls down again. The next day, you know, he sees it just before he's going to fall, but he still falls. The next day he sees it just before, and so jumps over it. The next day he sees it well in advance and just goes round it. And finally, he just doesn't even go down that street anymore. So it's that sort of thing. Our awareness, as it broadens, deepens, we just
We're so slow with that.
Oh, I'm afraid so.
It takes a long time to change the word. I'm afraid so.
So Sangharakshita says the spiritual life is measured in inches rather than miles. So it is that sense. But in a way, we can bring kashanti, we can bring patience to bear on that as well. You know, we can say, well, this is actually that spiritual progress is slow, but I can be patient with myself. And I can just allow that to, you know, but progress is possible. I mean, that's the important thing to know.
Has anyone come to understand why we're so slow? Because it's like a lack of reaction. It's like if you put your finger on something, it burns you. You get that quite quickly. But the manhole thing, that's a really slow one.
Yeah.
It's like a lack of responding to wisdom.
Yeah.
I don't think slowness is a problem. I think the slowness actually is the thing that can help. I mean, maybe I'm using slowness differently, but a lot of the time, actually, we do things because we're actually following our impulses. But if we slow right down, if you're walking down that road a bit slower, you're going to be paying more attention. Mm. So I think sometimes, actually, it's just actually slowing down, and also slowing down enough to kind of go, actually, where am I being wrong? Whereas if we're kind of going fast, that's what makes us make more mistakes more often, I think.
Yeah.
Can be. I was thinking also with that is that we don't see, you know, the unsatisfactoriness deep enough in a way. Maybe that's it. And when we begin to see it more clearly, then we begin to really, that motivates us to actually really change. And you can see that in the great Buddhist masters. They've, you know, they see it really, and they don't waste a minute, as it were. Whereas, you know, we can just sort of waste a lot of time, can't we? And then we do it in dribs and drabs. But I'm wondering about this likes and dislikes. Does anyone relate to that? You know, we're trying to find our happiness in the things we like and getting the things we like and avoiding the things we don't like. I mean, it's kind of how we live our lives, maybe. It's sort of a natural human way of living our lives.
But we are wrong so many times. And I don't know why we don't learn that we are so often wrong.
Right. Yeah. It takes a long time, as we were saying, doesn't it? It's a slow progress.
Yeah. Well, I think that's partly because a lot of us seem to be predisposed to want familiarity, however wrong that is actually for you in your situation. It's somehow you're compelled to go for the familiar.
Repeatedly. Yes.
Because it's actually very challenging to change.
Yes.
I'm just oversimplifying.
No, but I take your point. I think that's a good point. It is, we want the known, don't we? We don't like to go into the unknown, and you know, we don't know, even if the unknown might be positive, as it were, we prefer the known, even if it's you know, not actually very good for us. So do you see that maybe, so kashanti is getting at the, you know, one aspect of kashanti is being patient with whatever's going on for us, even if it's unpleasant. You're saying what's unpleasant isn't necessarily bad for us. It's not necessarily unskillful. It could be. So we're sitting in meditation. Maybe you've been on retreat, or you've been meditating for a long while, and actually you begin to not want to be there. You know, your body begins to ache, But actually staying with it can be a really positive thing, as long as it's not a real severe pain and you're doing yourself harm. But quite often it's the mind that's playing something out, isn't it? We want to scratch or move around. But actually, have you had the experience where you stay with it, you stay still? And then actually staying with the uncomfortable feelings, it actually has quite a positive effect. Maybe you come out with a bigger perspective, or you feel quite different when you finish the meditation. you know, because otherwise, you know, we would, I don't know if you've got this experience, you know, if you meditate on your own, it's quite easy to move around or maybe get up and check something, sit down again. But if you're meditating with others, one of the great things about it, you can't do it as easily, can you? So actually, it's really helpful in that aspect, isn't it? To have others there to support ourselves in keeping with it.
I think it's a really powerful theme, this idea that unhappiness is when things don't go according to our likes and dislikes. In a broader sense, you think about modern life, how there are so many shoulds, so many expectations of how our life should go, maybe what we should have achieved, or what we should have, or what we should want.
Yeah.
When you really look at that and you start to take that apart, you realise...
Yes.
How much unhappiness actually is just in all those things, you know, the things we see, the posters on the tube, and a whole lot of advertising.
That's right. There's a lot of expectations there, isn't it? There's an expectation that we were fed that we can be happy. And like Subhadramati was saying at the break about, you know, if we only get, you know, those... whatever it is, you know, this food or this clothes, then we'll be happy as well. That's what we've fed there. And it's sort of an instant gratification as well, isn't it, that often we're growing up with this idea that we can meet our needs immediately, as opposed to, just being with the discomfort, being with not getting what we want, in some ways actually is a more positive thing for us.
Yeah, perhaps life is a bit more reactive rather than kind of rolling out a plan, and that's what then you might expect. You would. It was obviously different between hoping for something and something that should happen.
And I think that it's just my opinion, but I think part of the problem of what we have actually, I don't know what we're going to call it, the postmodern condition or whatever, where we're kind of told to get this and get that. Part of it is that we're fed this delusion that actually it's what you can get out, feed these comforts. And actually, maybe the thing that makes us happiest, and we certainly find this as we put that effort into practice, but in other things, it's not what you get out, actually. We need to turn that on its head, it's what we put in. And it's only by actually kind of through focus, through determination, actually, that the real rewards come. That's my experience, I think. So I think what's happening is all these adverts and all these things that we're told to go for, that's just the content. I think the real problem, I think the real problem might be actually the subtle thing behind it, which is that we're trying to constantly feed ourselves with the content, and it doesn't matter what content is, what the content is. It's just that we've got to stop trying to get things and maybe just give more.
I think it's a good point there, isn't it? Yeah. Hello.
May I just make one point? I brought this up in our little group, basically, because I was brought up in a very poor area. During the last war, and we had very few facilities. We didn't have a water supply, we didn't have proper toilets, nothing like that at all. In the countryside with no modern facilities that most people probably thought went out with the ark, but they were still here. I can tell you when I left that place, when I was 18, and so we're talking about getting on to 1960 by then. And so I always remember what we were told by our parents, myself and my two older brothers, and that is, life is what you make it. And that's always been with me. And throughout the whole of this discussion that's going on, that's been going round and round in my mind. Life is what you make it. And that's precisely what Buddhist teaching is all about as well, amazingly, it is. You know, if you go running after things because you want them, won't necessarily get them, basically. And, you know, this kind of whole business of having a fairly level feeling towards life, and I'm getting up in my mid-70s, And basically, you know, there's a lot of knocks that you get as you get older that you have to put up with, basically. And it's learning to live with all those problems, basically. Otherwise, you're going to be absolutely miserable.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because you do see that, don't you? That people who just won't accept.
Absolutely.
And it's very painful, yes. Isn't it? It's
very painful. I accept that I'm getting up old, but I still do what I can do and what I like to do. There are certainly things that I'd like to do that I can no longer do it. You know, I can walk great distances, but I can no longer ride a bike. Not allowed to. So I don't drive a car. Not allowed to. And so all of these things, basically, you have to rethink your life out.
So it's almost a reimagining.
Yeah, and it's always a positive perspective effort that you're making rather than looking at things negatively.
Right, yeah.
And I think a lot of what's being said tonight is all about that, to be quite honest, when you start to analyse it.
Yes, yeah. So maybe we'll just move on to the next bit. So Shantideva says, with practice, anything becomes easy. So I think it's brilliant. That was a brilliant line. And it sort of really helped, you know, personally, that really helps me think, oh, I can't do this. You know, maybe, you know, meditate. I was talking to someone at the break saying they were struggling to meditate every day. It's all right, it's nobody here. But, you know, what he's saying, with practice, anything becomes easy. And it means we can just take on stuff that, even if we've got a story saying we can't do it, we can actually do it. We just do it bit by bit, and it will become more gradually easier for us as we learn the way. So what do you think about that? Is that in your experience, or you disagree?
It's easy to fall down the manhole as well.
Yeah. But you got the next day when you...
It's not always the case, though, is it?
So, could you say...
It's not a lot. I've been trying to play pool for, like, 3 years. It's still rubbish.
Right. I think meditation as well. The longer you do it, the more difficult it becomes, to be quite honest. You know, there's not some great thing that's going to just say, oh, great, I've got it now, and I can hold on to it. You can't. It becomes more and more difficult to hold on to it.
So I'll just read the rest of the thing, just might give it perspective. It says, so by learning to tolerate slight discomforts, even great pain becomes bearable. So we should practice seeing the discomfort caused by bugs, fleas and mosquitoes, hunger and thirst, or itches and rashes as nothing to bother about. Then we'll be able to graduate to the suffering caused by cold and heat, rain and wind, travelling, illness, and eventually even imprisonment and beatings. If we don't learn to tolerate these things, our mental distress will just make us suffer even more. That's quite something, isn't it? So... I think, as we were saying before, well, we're all probably going to grow old, we're going to get sick at some point, and we are going to die. So we are going to face difficulties in our life, even, you know, maybe we've already faced them already in our lives. So what he's saying is, if, you know, the more we can deal with the minor stuff, the more we'll be able to tolerate the bigger stuff when it arrives. Otherwise, we are going to suffer even more. A sobering thought, isn't it, really?
I think there is something to actually like putting yourself through a bit of discomfort, because pain doesn't seem quite so scary then. I mean, my personal experience is that I quite like pleasure, and I quite set my life up for that,
yes,
and I'll do everything possible to avoid the pain.
Yeah.
And when I actually sort of sit with pain, actually, you know, it's got some benefits to it. If you look at pleasure, it really just goes everywhere. I mean, you get intoxicated literally by it. Whereas pain is quite predictable. well, like if you've got a pain when you're sitting, You can watch that, and it becomes not so painful, just interesting in a way. And I'm not talking about desperate pain, but it does make other things less bothersome. So I can see on my sort of very light edge Western sort of view. I was thinking of bugs and fleas. I don't think I would put up with it very easily. Or you sort of really have to make an effort if you see a mosquito going, oh gosh. But that noise sends you off into sort of panic. Actually, it's just a noise.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, it's a good point, isn't it? It's interesting where you notice that the discomfort is transformed in you when you've been meditating. You've noticed, so it's not something that will stay as it is, as it were. It's something that will change as well.
I find that I like reading a lot, and like non-fiction, some of it's more constructive, but sometimes it's always, when you're practicing, you actually feel you're like, yeah, getting better at it when you're practicing, because reading, you could just read loads and loads and loads and be like, yeah. Oh, interesting, but then you're not actually soaking it in. And I, that's one of the reasons why I like meditation.
Yeah, that's right. It's important to actually practice these things, isn't it? Not just read about them. Yeah, it's really important. I was thinking about a daily thing, you know, probably for most Londoners, you know, catching the tube. You know, we go there and we get on the tube platform and it says, you know, the train's been delayed, you know, it'll be delayed 10 minutes. And I don't know about you, but I can get quite like, oh, this is ridiculous, you know. Oh, it's 10 minutes, you know. I mean, really, you know, most of the time it's not really going to cause me great hardship, really. I'm in the dry, I'm in the warm. Yet, you know, we can get into sort of, you know, these minor irritations can sort of, you can just build, we can build a whole story around it. Begin to blame, you know, London Underground, we can blame the tube drivers or whatever it is. And we can work ourselves into all sorts of a state just from something quite minor.
What I find the most confusing is like when you know that you're something's going to make you, I'm not forgive you, you'll be unskillful, like, I don't know, eating too much chocolate or whatever, and you just actively choose it because you just feel perverse and that's going to move you. So it's like the manhole story, but you just go, sod it, so jump in.
Yeah.
And like, what's going on there when you, you know I'll do that and I'll feel better, and you don't choose that. You want to feel bad, like maybe pain is because predictable or something, or that's what always happens. Or that's,
Maybe there is, you know, that sense of, you know, we want the predictable, we want the known, and maybe there is something like that. Did you want this?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it's pain. I think you get an initial sense, you get a high. So when you bite into that cake, or when you, you know, spend frivolously, or, you know, that first drink, whatever, you get a hit, you get a high, and that's why people keep going back to it, because it's exciting.
Yes.
So
yes.
When you keep eating too many cakes, become a beast, and it's not fun anymore.
I guess that's to do with perspective, isn't it? I know when I used to drink, I didn't sort of think, oh, I'm going to have a hangover tomorrow morning, or I didn't really take it on. And when I started meditating, that became more and more clear. My awareness just, oh yeah, what am I doing here? Because I'm going to feel rubbish tomorrow. And why am I doing this to myself? I'm harming myself. So maybe it's to do with perspective. We don't always have a bigger perspective to know that we are harming ourselves at a greater level. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And maybe, because I was going to say to that lady that it's not, even if it's not a thing like eating a cake, it's like feeling angry with someone, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And choose to be angry with that person. But maybe it is the same thing. You do get a bit of a high from that.
Exactly. It can feel good in a certain sense for a short period of time, but what we're not taking on board is the damage we're doing to ourselves. We're harming ourselves, and if we act it out, other people as well, we kind of don't care. for that sense of, as we were saying before, that over-focused, you know, well, I'm just going to tell them how it is. And it just sort of, there's a sort of feel-good to it, doesn't it? But it's harmful. Yeah.
Self-righteous.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth saying, isn't it, and it ties in with the habit that's, like, so I think it's harmful in the moment to ourselves.
Yes.
But also it's harmful that it makes that propensity to do that.
Yeah.
It deepens that groove.
Yes.
It's the opposite of things become easier if you practice.
Yes.
But well, it's the same, isn't it? If I'm irritable,
I'm
more likely to be irritable the next time.
Yes.
Even worse, I'll just build up a trend on myself.
Yeah.
And then that is really hard to get out of, like we've been talking about, because you practiced it for, so it's become like second nature.
That's right.
It's hard to turn that round, which maybe ties in with what we were saying earlier. Why is it so hard to change? Because we've got so used to it.
Yes.
I quite like that image of you just deepen the groove.
Yes.
More and more.
Yeah, it's like forming these negative or positive habits, isn't it? And we're strengthening what, you know, so there's everything we do either strengthens our positive or negative habits, doesn't it? So I'm aware of the time. I'm afraid we've come to the end of the class. So, thanks very much for coming along. And next week we're going to be exploring another paramita. So we look forward to seeing you there.